Thank you, Chairman.
Who said
this and when? We're now in the midst of another wave of innovation in finance. The change is now underway and most dramatic in the rapid growth of instruments for risk transfer and risk management, the increased role played by non-bank financial institutions in capital markets around the world, and the much greater integration of national financial systems. These developments provide substantial benefits to the financial system. Financial institutions are able to measure and manage risk much more effectively. Risks are spread more widely across a more diverse group of financial institutions within and across countries. These changes have contributed to a substantial improvement in the financial strength of the core financial intermediaries and in the overall flexibility and resilience of the financial system. The answer is that it was said by Tim Geithner, then chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, in 2006. And that might prompt in your mind two questions, both, I think, good questions. Firstly, how did Geithner get it so wrong? And secondly, given that he did get it so wrong, why was it that Geithner went on not to be fired, but to be promoted to what is probably the most important economic and financial job in the world, secretary to the US Treasury Department, a position he was elevated to in 2008 after the financial crisis? These, as I say, are, I think, two good questions. I'm going to talk mainly about the first, although I will have a word or two at the end to say about the second. How did he get it so wrong? Well, to understand that, we need to understand a little bit about the economics of risk and risk-taking. And certainly for the last 50 years, economists have modelled risk essentially as if risk were another commodity. It's a commodity for which there is a market in which people can buy and sell risks. And if you ask why would people trade risks, they would trade risks for several reasons. The first is that some people are better able to bear risks than others. If you have the risk of gaining or losing £100, that is a risk which is much easier to manage if you are very rich than if £100 is the only money which you have in the world. So people who find risk difficult in that sense may choose to sell these risks to people who find them easier to take. Secondly, initial risk exposures may differ. So there are risk that aggravates risk for one particular group of individuals may reduce the risk faced by another. That's the kind of standard story we tell students in which ice cream manufacturers trade with umbrella manufacturers and reduce the risks faced by each. Both these reasons are compelling reasons why people might sell risks to each other and reduce not the overall risk which exists in the world, but the costs of bearing the risks which exist in the world. Thirdly, people might have different risk preferences. Some people might like bearing risks, and others might dislike bearing risks. Now, that's a more complicated set of reasons. But actually, if we make a certain variety of rationality assumptions, which are conventional in economics, although controversial, then that kind of trading resembles trading of the first and second kind, and it reduces the overall cost of risk bearing, even though it doesn't reduce the amount of risk. So the key we should understand is that risk trading that is motivated by these two or perhaps three motives has the effect, even though the aggregate risk remains the same, the social and economic cost of handling it is reduced. But there is a fourth reason why people trade risks, and that fourth reason is that different people make different assessments of the same risk. And you will see that that is a more problematic source of risk transfer. And it's a more problematic risk transfer because in these different assessments, it's likely that one of the parties that is making the assessment is right and the other is wrong, or at any rate that one of them is more right than the other. And there's a further paradox there that we may never know who is right and who is wrong, but sometimes we will discover that that is indeed the case. And when we discover that is indeed the case, the costs of this transfer of risks may turn out to be high, and it may turn out to be significant, even in cases where the truth about the underlying risk structure does not completely emerge. So if we're to understand the growth of risk trading in financial markets, we need to ask ourselves the question, what are the dominant motives for this kind of trade? Now, the truth is, in financial markets, all four of these motives explain the trade that goes on. Some people are better able to bear risks. That's why one of the reasons why insurance companies are better placed to take the risk of your house burning down than you are. Initial risk exposures differ. That's the hedging motive for risk. Some people like risks, other people have the characteristic we describe as extreme risk aversion. And different people make assessments of the same risks. So it matters if we're to understand the explosion of trade in risk markets, which went on in the 90s and the noughties. If we're to understand that explosion in risk and trade in risk bearing, we need to understand why it was that that explosion in risk trading came about. Now, I think we know with hindsight that the motive for that explosion in risk taking was not primarily motives 1, 2, and 3. It was motive 4. Different people made different assessments of the same risk. And we've already seen that that kind of motive for risk bearing trading has quite different economic consequences to the first two and possibly the third. In other words, it really mattered to understand what was going on in this sense, in this system. And Geithner and others like him believed that what was going on was 1 and 2, that is, we heard extensive arguments about how the creation of ever more complex securities had the effect of enabling people to finally match their particular holdings to their particular risk preferences. But what was mainly going on was actually the fourth. I learned really about the fourth motive when I became involved in the early 90s in some work done in the reconstruction of the Lloyd's insurance market. And what had happened then is Lloyd's is principally what we call a reinsurance market. That means the primary insurer takes the first tranche of a particular risk, and then the reinsurer agrees to insure the portion that lies above that. And reinsurers take on portfolios of tail risks in this sense, and manage these portfolios with very large reserves in order to handle it. That was the traditional model of reinsurance. But people discovered, particularly in the 1980s, that if you could sell reinsurance, you could sell reinsurance of reinsurance. And if you could sell reinsurance of reinsurance, you could sell reinsurance of reinsurance of reinsurance. And so it went on, and it did go on. And on and on. And if you ask what was happening at each stage of these trades, the answer was people who knew a little bit about the risks they were underwriting were passing these risks on to people who knew less about the risks they were underwriting. And that is how people who had absolutely no idea of the risks they were underwriting, rich British individuals who had been induced to become Lloyd's names, found themselves taking on the reinsurance of reinsurance of reinsurance of reinsurance. And that all started to go wrong in 1987 when an oil rig called Piper Alpha went on fire in the North Sea. That was then the largest single claim which had been made on the Lloyd's insurance market. The result was that it started triggering reinsurance contracts. It went on to trigger reinsurance of reinsurance contracts. It went on to trigger the next layer of contracts. It went on to trigger the next layer of contracts until people who had never heard of an oil rig called Piper Alpha discovered that, in fact, they had insured Piper Alpha not just once, but over and over and over and over again. And that was the mechanism by which some of the stately homes of England had to be sold up to meet the losses which people had made in the Lloyd's insurance market. That made me relatively well placed, I think, that experience, to understand what was going on in the creation of complex securities for tranching credit risks in the course of the early years of this century. Better placed, it seemed, than Mr. Geithner was, because Mr. Geithner was persuaded by the arguments that said what is going on is risk trading of one and two. If what happened in Lloyd's went wrong with Piper Alpha, what happened in credit markets started to go wrong in the summer of 2007, when famously David Viniar, the chief financial officer of Goldman Sachs, announced that we were experiencing 25 standard deviation moves several days in a row. Now, Andy has actually produced, I think, in one of his papers, the number that expresses the probability of a 25 standard deviation events. There are enough noughts on it to go into more than one line. All of you in this room know that 25 standard deviation events simply do not happen. What had happened to Mr. Viniar and Goldman Sachs in 2007 was not that a risk which was in their model but at the extreme end of possible experience within the model had materialized. What was happening was the new events had occurred that were not accommodated within their particular model. And we all understand that. So one of the simplest mathematical models you can construct that I use to make this point to people is the one where you arrive at a bus stop. You know that the buses come every 10 minutes, but you don't know the schedule on which they arrive. And then there's a simple model of that process that says every minute you stand waiting there for a bus, the probability that the bus will arrive in the next minute increases until after you've been waiting for 9 minutes, it's absolutely certain that the bus will arrive in the next minute. Now, we all know it's not quite like that, that the arrival of buses has not only a frequency element but a stochastic element, and we can extend the model to take account of that. Interestingly, it still generally has the property that the longer you wait for a bus, the more probable it is that the buses are about to arrive. But none of us really believe that. We all know that if you've been waiting 15 minutes for a bus, by that time, which you believe comes every 10 minutes, by that time, you are rather doubtful whether the bus is going to come. You're rather doubtful not because you think you're seeing something at the extreme ends of the probability of distribution of outcomes within your model. You're starting to be uncertain about the applicability of your particular model. Until by the time you've got to be waiting for the bus for half an hour, it's only people who are very much the slaves of some particular mental model who are still there waiting for the bus. Now, what we've described here is an entirely general phenomenon of using models in this kind of way, that the extreme percentiles of experience in a risk distribution typically come not from extreme elements with extreme probabilities within the model, they come from events that lie outside the model. And once you've understood that, you will realize that using risk models in this kind of way is an exercise which breaks down in precisely the situation where you are dependent on these models. The extreme probabilities within the model, the extreme probabilities of the distribution of outcomes, typically come from off-model events. If you toss a coin 100 times and it comes down heads 100 times, it's possible that if you've experienced an event of quite extraordinary low probability, but it is much more likely that there is another explanation of why it is the coin keeps coming down heads. Extreme probabilities come from off-model events. Now that takes us to asking why it is we see breakdowns in these kind of systems. And that leads, I think, directly to a different kind of literature than the one which has been used to analyse these effects. It's the kind of literature which is used to analyse extreme events that occur from time to time in engineering systems. The kind of events that Charles Perrow, writing in the first instance about the disaster, or rather the near disaster but non-disaster at Three Mile Island, called normal accidents. And what Perrow meant by a normal accident was an unanticipated interaction of multiple failures in a complex system. And that description describes what happened in 2007-2008 and what happened in various other financial collapses pretty well. The product of the unanticipated interaction of multiple failures in a complex system. And in Perrow's analysis which has been subsequently used by him and others to analyse similar events and failures in engineering and physical systems, is generated by a combination of two factors, extreme complexity on the one hand and tight coupling on the other. Extreme complexity is self-explanatory. Tight coupling means there is no, as it were, looseness or redundancy in the system. One disastrous event quite quickly has consequences that spread throughout the system. And Perrow made the important point that additional safety regimes, whose effect is almost inevitably to add further complexity to the system, may actually increase rather than reduce the probability of overall failure in the system, and that was true in several of the normal accidents which Perrow described. So that leads us to say perhaps we shouldn't be thinking about the way in the system in the way in which Geithner was thinking about it. Perhaps we should be looking, as Geithner conspicuously was not. And if you go through that speech Geithner made to the Association of Risk Professionals, you find a great deal of discussion of the risk which exists within individual financial institutions, and you learn nothing about the risks which were characteristic of the system taken as a whole. But it is the risk which was characteristic of the system taken as a whole, risk which was not effectively modelled in the kind of mechanisms that Vinier and others were using, which caused the collapse of 2007-2008. And that takes us to the ways in which people who design these complex engineering and physical systems have tried to construct systems to reduce, at least, you cannot eliminate, but to reduce the probability of normal accidents. The first and overriding requirement is to reduce avoidable complexity. And the fundamental question we have to be asking ourselves is how much of the additional complexity which has been added to financial systems over the last two or three decades, how much of that complexity actually serves important social purposes. And if we conclude that they don't, we probably ought to be stripping a lot of that out. We need to have loose coupling, not tight coupling, wherever possible. That means we need to emphasize redundancy in the system so that there are alternative paths, so that the failure of one particular element doesn't permits you to use alternative pathways in order to achieve the same effects in different ways. And modularity that enables a failed element of the system to be isolated and shut down without destroying the properties and the functioning of the system as a whole. We need to look at the financial system in aggregate with a view to removing avoidable complexity, with a view to reducing the tightness of the connections between individual elements of the system, and with a view to creating as much redundancy and modularity as we can. But that is not, in the main, the direction in which we are travelling. And if we ask why, I think we might go back to the somewhat puzzling second question with which I began, which is, why is it that Geithner, far from being suffering for his misjudgment of the events that led up to the crisis, was actually promoted to handle the fallout of the consequences? And the answer is that Geithner's value rests in his detailed knowledge both of the individuals and of the institutions in which these individuals operate within the financial system. We're talking about people, and there are a great many such people around the financial system, who know a great deal about the individual parts of the system, but a very little sense of the system as a whole or of the properties of that system as a whole. A lack of understanding, which was revealed by the failure to comprehend the weaknesses of the system, which is revealed so clearly in that quote with which I began and in the speech from which it is extracted. We have the paradox that knowing a great deal about the detail of the system, but it's a paradox which you find in engineering systems as well. Knowing a great deal about the detail of the system does not actually necessarily equip you to manage or understand the operation of the system taken as a whole. And it's that understanding of the system as a whole that is required if we're to adopt approaches which enable us to avoid crises of the kind we experienced in 2007, 2008, and will inevitably experience again. Thank you.